From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, new discoveries in science with Michael Tellinger. Also, today was Flag Day, so I hope you remembered that. Here's what's happening. Science advisor Richard C. Hoagland has just sent me a story that we've been looking at for several days now, but this could get serious. And I say could, because we just don't know all about it yet. The Fort Calhoun, Nebraska nuclear power plant is apparently in possible serious trouble due to massive flooding. The NRC has declared a level 4 accident. The FAA has apparently issued the following directive, shutting down airspace over the plant. They had a fire there near one of the cooling systems about a week ago. But, of course, there's been rising water in the area, and they're concerned about that. I can't comment too much about this story yet, but we're going to continue to monitor it, okay? Federal regulators will require sunscreen manufacturers to test their products' effectiveness against sun rays that pose the greatest risk of skin cancer. Under new rules, they also will have to follow stricter guidelines when describing how well their products block ultraviolet B rays. The FDA announced new regulations designed to enhance effectiveness of sunscreens and make them easier to use. Sunscreens that don't protect against both ultraviolet A and B rays have a sun protection factor, or SPF, below 15 will have to carry this kind of a warning. The product has been shown only to help prevent sunburn, not skin cancer or early skin aging. Strange story. You've heard of the company, right? Scotts. If you fertilize your lawn, you might do it with Scotts products. Well, in an unlikely move for the head of a major company, Scotts chief executive Jim Hagedorn said that he's exploring targeting medical marijuana as well as other niches to help boost sales at his lawn and garden company. He simply says, I want to target the pot market. Sales at Scotts rose 5% last year to $2.9 billion. But the company relies on sales at three key retailers, Home Depot, Lowe's, and Walmart stores. And he said, you know what? That's a little dangerous, basically. So he's considering the marijuana market. 16 states so far have legalized medical marijuana, the largest being California and Colorado. The market will reach $1.7 billion in sales this year alone. Chris Conrad is a court-qualified expert witness on cannabis and a curator of the Hash Marijuana Hemp Museum in Amsterdam. Chris, let me ask you about this. Is this a smart business move? It seems to be a real market there.
I think it's a great marketing strategy, George, since nutrients are actually a major cost of growing medical marijuana, and they're highly inflated. So the patients will really benefit from having competition from a major producer instead of having to rely upon only the specialty nutrient companies.
And I assume if Scott gets into this, they're going to do it in a big way, Chris.
Yeah, you would think so. And, you know, people have used Miracle-Gro for years for their gardens and stuff. So it's really just kind of making an acknowledgement of something that's already been going on. And I think it's a brilliant stroke in marketing, to tell you the truth, especially, as you mentioned, we have this wave of medical marijuana laws that have swept the country. And now we have recently Kentucky decriminalized 8 ounces for personal use. So and California just had the vote on legalization and so forth. So, you know, they're positioning themselves to ride another wave forward once this happens. And I think it's a very good strategy.
Okay, we will monitor that one. Facebook might be in trouble. They're approaching 700 million members, but its growth is slowing and it's losing users in the United States and Canada. They did that last month. Facebook right now has 687 million members at the start of June. Facebook does not regularly release membership figures except to announce milestones, such as when it hit 500 million users in July of last year. But in the United States, they lost nearly 6 million users in May. Inside Facebook, which monitors these situations, said that it's been falling for some time. And Canada fell 1.52 million to 16 million during the month. And Britain, Norway, Russia all posted losses as well. Lauren Weinstein, of course, he monitors all these kinds of stories. Lauren, what's going on? What's the reason for the dropping off of memberships?
We don't really know. There's various ways to look at it. It's kind of fun to sit and speculate and saying, well, maybe there's Facebook fatigue, right? Maybe people are finally getting concerned about all the Facebook privacy problems and missteps in the way they roll out new features and things. But it's also possible that we're looking at some other, you know, less exciting sorts of things happening, at least from our standpoint. There are seasonal changes that occur in these kinds of memberships on these kinds of sites. And as you noted, they don't routinely release this kind of information. So we're working with imperfect data when we do these kinds of analysis in the first place. It appears that engagement with Facebook is actually up. In other words, the people that are using it right now are using it more. I've heard perhaps 40% more page views per visit.
Well, unlike MySpace, which had Facebook and Twitter come in and clobber it,
yeah.
There's nothing else out there now going after Facebook, is there?
Not yet. I mean, I assume there are going to be. I expect to see some serious attempts to cut away at what Facebook has right now. And it's very important that that happen, because having Facebook so dominant in what is becoming not only a social space but an identity space, it's not healthy to have one firm with that much control over that aspect of social. But I think what may be happening here is that statistically it appears that when Facebook goes into a country, once you get up to around the 50% population point that are actually engaged with Facebook and using Facebook, it sort of brick walls at that point, or at least slows down in terms of new people coming in. Because you've already reached the people who are interested in doing social that way. There's a lot of people who aren't online. They don't want to go online. They don't have fast enough connections to do something like Facebook. So you may be looking at kind of natural barriers that are very hard to get past. And as new competition comes online, of course, there'll be other factors that could hopefully cut into Facebook's hold on this industry as well.
Very good. Thanks, Lauren. Well, maybe the glamour with Facebook going away. The death toll from the tornado that devastated much of Joplin, Missouri on May 22nd has now risen to 153. The tornado cut a path of destruction nearly 14 miles long, nearly 7 miles of which were in the city limits. The southwest Missouri city has a population of 50,000 people. The Coasters, the lead singer Carl Gardner. He's died at the age of 83. The star passed away at a hospice in Florida. He had been suffering from congestive heart failure and dementia. Inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1987, the Coasters had hits, including like the one you just heard, Yakety Dayak in 1958. The song went to number one in the U.S. charts on Billboard's Hot 100 and was used as a theme for Clive James' television talk show in the United Kingdom during the 1990s. The United Nations, are they moving forward to a plan to confiscate your guns? Will the United States join 152 other countries to support this arms trade treaty resolution, which establishes the date for the 2012 UN conference intended to attack, apparently, American sovereignty by taking away the rights of Americans to keep and bear arms? Is that true? Up next, John Lott. We'll talk about this story on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. John Lott, senior research scientist at the University of Maryland, was the chief economist at the United States Sentencing Commission during 88 and 89. He received a PhD in economics. We've talked with him many times, a couple of his books, More Guns, Less Crime, The Bias Against Guns, and Freedomomics as well. John, let's talk about this United Nations trade resolution. First of all, how real is this thing?
Oh, I think it's very real. I mean, they almost got something through about 8 years ago or so, but President Bush at the time and John Bolton, who was the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, put the kibosh on it. But we're facing quite different political reality now. While John Bolton was willing to fight, tooth and nail in order to stop it, now we have an administration that's very sympathetic to the goals of registration and licensing and other regulations that they'd like to have in international rules.
Well, what will our Senate do when they are faced with the opportunity to vote on something like this? Are they going to really accept this?
I would hope, and I would think that there is a good chance that they'll stop it. But, even if we don't agree to it, we're going to be helping to impose rules on other countries around the world. And I think there's reasons to be concerned about individuals' rights to be able to own guns in other countries also. So, I mean, there are countries that don't have severe regulations right now, and this would put extreme political pressure on them to go and adopt rules that gun control advocates have been pushing worldwide.
Some of the things they'd like to do if they pass this, John Lott, as you know, enact tougher licensing requirements, making law-abiding citizens cut through even more bureaucratic red tape to legally own a firearm, confiscate and destroy all unauthorized civilian firearms, ban the trade, sale, and private ownership of all semi-automatic weapons, and create an international gun registry, setting the stage for full-scale gun confiscation. Do you think that's the plan? In the long-term plan is to confiscate guns, or do they just try to regulate, just want to monitor this stuff?
Well, when we look around the world, surely there's a lot of cases where we've had registration and licensing. It may have been the original goal of it just to, as they say, help solve crime, but we can talk about that because it's rarely, if ever, actually used for that. But eventually, after these rules have been in place for a decade or a couple decades or a few decades, you'll have some government that comes around that says that now that we have these lists, we can go and use them to confiscate guns. And that's happened every place from the UK to Australia, even in California, when we had requirements that people have to register so-called assault weapons that were there. There was confiscation of that list was used to confiscate certain types of assault weapons that people were owning at the time. And, so it's a real concern. You had something similar happen in Canada with some types of guns, but it's been quite a while since that's happened. But so that's the fear, that even if the people who initially want to have licensing and registration may have less than malevolent reasons for it, it often ends up getting used to take people's guns.
We've seen, John, this fiasco on what happened apparently when ATF folks gave permission to some Arizona gun shops to sell guns in a scam that they were trying to catch. What they ended up doing is putting a lot of assault weapons in the hands of Mexican drug lords and people like that. Truly a disaster. I mean, I really see this as an act to confiscate guns eventually worldwide.
Right.
I mean, I think governments would love to see populations without any guns, only their soldiers. Look what would happen, for example, in Libya, if it was just Gaddafi and his troops who had the guns.
No, I agree those are real concerns. Just one comment on the Mexican gun-running incident. They didn't just allow gun stores to go and sell those guns. There are many cases where the gun stores, when they would call up the BATF, would say, we don't want to sell these guns to these guys. And the government would tell them that they had to sell them to those individuals.
Yeah, they would say there's something wrong with these people. We feel uneasy about this. And I guess the feds kept saying, nah, sell it to them, sell it to them.
That's right. And we've had U.S. agents who have been killed by those very guns. And, of course, there's been bloodshed in Mexico. Just so people know, these are basically semi-automatic guns. There's nothing particularly special about them with regard to military-type uses. And I'm sure the cartels can go and get plenty of real military weapons if that's what they want to do, and they surely have the money to do it as they get everything from rocket launchers to grenades and other things that the drug cartels are able to get. They're not getting those from the United States. They're getting those from other places. But it has been, these guns have been used in crime, and rather than stopping, the U.S. government has actually been instrumental in making sure that these sales take place. But you know, your broader point about registration and licensing, I think there are real concerns. Now, the one benefit that is pointed out for registration and licensing, the American advocates claim, or if you look at a country like Canada, mm-hmm. is that they claim it's possible to go and solve crime. And if you look at it carefully, what you find is that there's virtually no cases where crime's been solved. Take Hawaii, which has had registration and licensing for 50 years or so. I testified before the Hawaii State Legislature in 2000, and they had the chief of police for Honolulu, and he was asked how many crimes, and he was alerted that he's going to be asked this question beforehand. He said, how many crimes have you been able to solve as a result of registration and licensing over all those years? And he said, zero. And there's a really simple reason for that, and that is virtually, in theory, if a gun's left at a crime scene and it's registered to the person who committed the crime, then you can pick it up and find out who it's registered to and trace it back to the person who committed the crime and catch them. A couple problems. One is crime guns are virtually never left at the crime scene. When they are, it's either because the criminal's been either wounded or killed. And you're going to catch them anyway when they go to the hospital or you have a dead body there. And two, even in the few cases where they are registered guns that you pick up, they're never registered to the person who committed the crime.
That's true.
And so, and that is an important lesson because the motivation for this international registration and licensing of guns is that if guns are sold on the black market and they end up getting into the hands of somebody fighting a conflict in some foreign country, then in theory you could go and trace it back to the original person that put these guns in play. Well, good luck. I don't think you're going to have any more luck with that than we have in terms of tracing crime guns here in the United States. The big source of guns that are used in international conflicts are governments. And we can go and look around the world. If you look at FARC in South America, which has been fighting Colombia, those guns basically come from Venezuela.
Well, and you've got you've got people out there though, John, like Adnan Khashoggi, who made billions in this kind of market, didn't they?
Oh, sure, of course. You're exactly right. And so, you know, when you have that much money at stake, and when you have governments involved with this, the notion that somehow making individuals have to go and register and license their guns, it's going to be completely irrelevant to this. And besides that, you know, the reason why governments are concerned about this is they don't like civilians in their countries getting a hold of guns and making it difficult for governments to go and do bad things. I'm sure Syria is very happy right now that it has very few people that are civilians that are armed in the country. So when they go and fire on groups of demonstrators, they don't have to worry about people firing back at the government. But so Syria is a big supporter of this, and other countries are. But it's not really obvious that that's the side we should be on, even in that case. I mean, there are lots. Sure, there are bad situations that occur with places like the Marxist rebels in South America.
Right.
But as I said, I think those are governments arming those individuals. When you have freedom fighters that are there, you know, someplace like the United States, if these rules go into effect, wouldn't be able to go and arm freedom fighters around the world. We wouldn't have been able to go and arm people fighting in Afghanistan against the Russians during the Reagan administration.
Well, as you've always said too, John, that a thug is going to bypass a place or a home or an individual if he thinks they're armed and go to the place where he thinks they don't have guns.
Right. So it's not just, it's probably much more important than the point that I was making, in the sense that we have crime around the world. There are lots of countries that have murder rates much, much higher than we have here in the United States, have other types of crime rates much higher than we have here. And, you know, it'd be great if the police in those countries were able to and willing to go and protect individuals, but in many times, they don't have the police forces that we have here in the United States. They don't have the response times that we have here. And even here, obviously, it's important that individuals be able to defend themselves. But in those countries, people have no alternative other than being able to defend themselves. And if you disarm them, you basically make it so that the criminals are able to go and get a hold of weapons, but the law-abiding good citizens can't.
All right, stay with us. John Lott, our special guest this hour. We're going to take your phone calls in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM for him, but one of the luxuries of Coast to Coast, I'd like your stories if you've ever been involved in a situation where you've had to use a gun. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, Michael Tellinger joins us as we talk about the fascination of ancient ruins and more on Coast to Coast AM. And when we come back in just a moment, John Lott takes your phone calls as we talk about the United Nations trying to take your guns. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. John, before we go to calls and some of these stories, couple things. First of all, what's new with your blog these days?
Well, one thing I just wrote up something on is new reports has come out from the Obama administration on the Brady background checks. And we're continuing to see about 98-99% of the denials being false positives, where just like you had Senator Ted Kennedy, the late Senator Kennedy, people may remember five different times he was stopped getting on airplanes because he was flagged on the terror don't watch list. Well, virtually all the people that end up getting denied being able to buy guns are law-abiding individuals who aren't prohibited individuals from being able to buy guns, but they have names that are similar to those who are prohibited. And the prohibited people aren't going trying to buy the guns. It's the law-abiding citizens virtually always who are being stopped and being delayed from getting a gun. And there are a few times where women who are being stalked or others who are facing imminent problems and have tried to go and buy guns quickly have found that they can't get it when they need it.
Go through the statistics about states that have passed concealed carried laws, John. Crime does go down.
Well, that's right. And by the way, just today, just yesterday, the state Senate in Wisconsin voted 25-8 to be the 49th state to allow individuals to be able to carry permitted concealed handguns. It's pretty much a foregone conclusion also in the state house there, and the governor is going to sign it. So that means that only Illinois is going to be the only remaining state in the country that will ban citizens being able to go and carry concealed handguns
right.
for protection.
And its legislature voted on that just a few months ago and defeated it.
Right. Well, they had a majority, but they had to have, because of the rules that were adopted in the House there on preemption, they had to have a supermajority. They had to have two-thirds of the House vote for it. They couldn't quite make that. Governor Quinn twisted a few arms and was able to get the number just barely back under the two-thirds that they needed. But, it's going to happen. I mean, I remember when I used to testify in Ohio, one of the last states to go and adopt a right to carry law, how the attitude changed over time. When the first time I went there, they were saying, well, they had all these horror stories about what would happen. The last time I went there, every state around Ohio had allowed individuals to go and carry concealed handguns. And you could say, well, were you afraid of leaving the state? You know, if you go to Pennsylvania where they have, now there's like 800,000 people in Pennsylvania that have a permit to carry a concealed handgun. Were they afraid? Were they afraid when they went into Indiana, which has had a law since the 1920s, or Kentucky or Michigan? The answer was obviously no. And you could see that the predictions of horrible things that would happen in each of those states, as they didn't come true, just affected the credibility of those who were trying to fight it. And eventually, Illinois will change too. But this gets to the results question that you're asking about. I mean, not only do we find that permit holders are extremely law-abiding, that they lose their permits for any reason, hundreds or thousands of one percentage point, but we find that just as you can deter criminals with higher arrest rates or higher conviction rates or longer prison sentences, the fact that a would-be victim might be able to defend themselves also deters criminals from committing crimes. And You see, for each additional year that a right to carry law is in effect, you'll see about 1.5% drop in murder rates over and above what would have happened otherwise, and about a 2% drop in robbery and aggravated assault rates.
What was the story a couple months ago? Someone breaks into a house, realizes that the person in the house has a gun. The perpetrator is so petrified, he locks himself in the bathroom and calls police.
Yeah, but the guy didn't even know whether the individual had a gun. He assumed it was so likely or sufficiently likely that he locks himself in the bathroom and calls the police because he's just worried that the person might have a gun. So,
I broke into a house. I'm locked in the bathroom. I'm afraid that the guy that owns the house might have a gun and kill me. Help. Get me out of here.
Right.
Let's take some calls here, John. Let's go to Blair in Pleasant Hill, California. Get us started on the wild card line. Hi, Pierre.
Hi, this is Peter. How you guys doing?
Good.
Doing great.
Senator Law, I just wanted to tell you you should run for president. With your constitutional stance and at the helm of this country, you'd be a lot better off and more powerful in the world. George, I thank you for having me on your show.
Sure.
It was 1981, and I was having a problem with I lived down in Norwalk by Buena Park. And at that time, there's a lot of Hispanic gang members. There still are. And at the time, I was 16 years old. I was a cross-country runner. Long story short, I got in an argument with their leader over a girl, and he and his friends chased me home. I was running, and they were on bicycles. Well, I made it home, ran into the house. I grabbed my dad's .45, went out on the porch, told him to leave. Most of them did immediately, except their leader walked up on my lawn and said, "Shoot me with that gun." And I proceeded to put 2 rounds into the ground at his feet. He took off. Then I went inside the house. I called the sheriff's department. They said, "Next time, shoot him and drag him in the house."
Oh, wow. But,
yeah. But, you know, that was the situation with that. And because I was able to show a level of force, they all took off. There
That's
was
right.
about 8 or 9 of them.
That and, is absolutely right.
And without the First and Second Amendment, the rest of the Constitution may as well be toilet paper because we won't be able to defend it. You know, when our forefathers developed and created the Second Amendment, it was so that we could protect ourselves from tyrannical governments and oppressive peoples, and even if it was our own government. And, you know, it's like what Edward Abbey says or said, you know, sometimes you have to fight your government to protect your country. And, you know, I hope it doesn't come to that, but there's a lot of people that if they decided to confiscate guns, you're going to see a lot of violence.
We are going to have a problem if they do that. John Lott, and the people who have the right to carry concealed, they also, though, need to be very careful when they pull that gun because states crack down on them very, very viciously, don't they?
Oh, I think you have to be extremely careful. I mean, if you go and use the gun improperly, you're committing a crime. And law-abiding citizens have a lot to lose by going and committing a crime and getting locked up in jail.
I mean, if a guy breaks into your house, he's not armed, but he breaks in and you shoot him to death, can you get convicted for some second-degree murder or something like that?
Well, you can. It depends on the state that you're living in. There are states that have so-called stand your ground or castle doctrine rules. And the opposite of that is many states will require that you have to retreat as far as possible before you use your gun. The stand your ground rules basically say that, you know, if somebody's there, there's a reasonable person test for whether or not you're allowed to use what level of force to protect yourself. But there are lots of cases I can give you where people retreated, but prosecutors would argue you could have retreated further. There's one particularly egregious example that I came across a while ago in Oklahoma where a 67-year-old man had pulled into a parking lot. He was attacked by a robber. The robber knocked him down. The 67-year-old got up, tried to run away. The robber knocked him down a second time. The 67-year-old man got up again, tried to run away, got knocked down a third time. And it was at that third time he pulled out his permanent concealed handgun and fatally shot the attacker. problem was the prosecutor argued that since the attacker wasn't armed, that he could have gone further in terms of trying to avoid the confrontation that was there.
Right.
The 67-year-old man argued that, you know, this guy was much stronger than he was. He was much younger. He was like 28. And there's just no way that he was going to be able to protect himself. And the third time after he was knocked down, he was scared that he wasn't going to be able to get up, and he was worried that the guy was going to beat him. And so there are questions there of judgment there, and you have to be careful because not all prosecutors are going to see things the same way. So, you know, it's better to have an option to be able to go and protect yourself in many of these cases. And in the 67-year-old man's case, he was convicted, but there was no prison time. They just wanted to send a message that people should be careful in using their guns. And, you know, so you can get the types of situations that you're talking about. But I think most people, most members of a jury, if it ever gets that far, know the type of fear that somebody faces, and you could see in these stories when you read the trial transcripts that the people who used their guns, they weren't looking forward to use it. They pulled it out as an absolute last resort because they knew that they had so much to lose if something were to go wrong.
That's a good point. Let's go to our first-time caller, Gary, in Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Gary. Go ahead. Good morning.
Hi, George. How are you?
Good.
Professor Latta, I would just like to ask, I really do think that both sides should be heard, and I think that it would be a good idea to explain to the nation who Mary Rosch is.
Who is Mary Rosch? I don't know who she is.
It was something my kids had set up where they had, it was their email accounts that they had used. So, and it was basically the first letters of my four kids' first names, Maxim, Ryan, Roger, Sherwin. And my son Maxim had posted a review of More Guns, Less Crime that he had written. And he had used that in setting up the account on Amazon. Basically, as something to go and, be nice to his dad for putting up a review.
Ah, okay. Well, there it is. Let's go to Charles in Nashville, Tennessee. Charles, east of the Rockies. Go ahead.
How you doing, George and Professor?
Fine, Charles.
I wanted to ask the professor, I've done some bad things in my time, man, but my question is tonight, they just passed that new law for the FBI to go in any place without a search warrant and can investigate anybody without a search warrant, basically giving agents authority to do just about anything, go through your garbage or anything, and arrest anybody. And I want your comments on that. And also, yes.
I'm not familiar with any such law. FBI agents still have to go and get search warrants. I mean, there's Patriot Act issues, and there's differences that they have in terms of getting certain types of search warrants if you're dealing with drug dealers, that they can get things more easily. But you still basically have to go and get search warrants, some type of blanket one that can cover different contingencies there. So I don't think there may be things to worry about, and I'm sure there are, but whether or not the police being able to go into anybody's house anytime with a search warrant or the FBI being able to do that is not one thing you have to worry about quite yet.
Let's go to Sedona, Arizona. It's Blair's turn on Coast to Coast. Hey, Blair, how are you?
George, seeing your buff pics on the Coast site empowers my notion that to many of us baby boomers, 60 is the new 40.
We're working on it at least, aren't we?
Hey, I was thinking of Colonel John Alexander and Professor Lott together because of the non-lethal technology he's working with. There might be some solutions there with both those on a guest one time, you know?
Maybe. I'd love to have one of those little devices where you just aim it at someone, render them, you know, useless. They fall to their knees and you don't have to shoot the person. But
there you go. That's it. Well, I had a surreal experience in the Navy in Norfolk. I was a dispersing clerk, a paymaster, and I had $750,000 cash in two grocery bags in each arm with a 45 caliber strapped to my waist. And, of course, it was an empty chamber. The clip was on the opposite side per Navy regulations. I wonder if that's changed, George.
I don't know. I didn't have to carry a gun with the Navy, just a pen.
Well, you were a W-1 pay grade, weren't you?
I was a W-2
pay W-2?
Grade. Yep.
Oh, my goodness. The leave and earning statements and stuff. Well, Professor Lott, I appreciate your support of the Second Amendment, and keep up the good work, sir.
Thanks, Blair.
There's one thing I was going to mention. I don't know if you saw this, but about a month ago, the Washington Post reported on a story where Sarah Brady had met with President Obama. And he had told her that he was working on lots of things, but they were under the radar that people couldn't see with regard to gun control issues. I mean, we can see the Supreme Court nominees that he's put up and things like banning the importation of semi-automatic rifles and some other things that he's been doing. But, you know, it looks like a second Obama administration may have some nasty surprises for people.
Roger in Lakeside, California. It's your turn, Rog. Go ahead.
Thank you very much, George. It's good to talk with you again, and thank you so much for having Professor Lott on. This is really a fantastic topic. I wanted to relate to you a story that happened to me about 15 years ago. I had three drug addict burglars breaking into my mom's house, and I was able to not only defend myself with a 1911 A1 45 ACP pistol, but I was able to turn them over to the sheriffs, and the sheriffs thanked me very much for doing my duty as a citizen and getting the criminals off the street. The problem is the prosecutor ended up giving them a light six-month sentence in the honor camp, even though they had, according to the sheriff's department, they had criminal records as long as their arm. So I hope we never lose our Second Amendment rights to defend ourselves, because if we do, we're in trouble. By the way, George, you might be interested in this, and you too, John. I didn't have a cell phone with me, and I got the attention of my neighbor to call the sheriff. And once she told the sheriff that I was holding three criminals with a gun, they got there in less than 10 minutes.
Wow. Yeah, they do move fast. Rog, thanks for that story. John, we're wrapping things up here, but I want you to tell us, how do people get to your blog? It's well worth reading all the time.
Oh, well, thanks, George. It's johnrlott.com. Just my name, John R. Lott, middle initial R, Lott.com. But I appreciate that.
What's your gut tell you? Where's this all going to take us, John Lott?
Well, I don't know. We have a lot of battles that still have to come up. There's a lot of cases around the country right now dealing with where we go after the Chicago and D.C. gun ban cases for the Supreme Court. And those are really going to make a huge difference on where people are going to be able to carry guns and where they're going to be able to use them. But we've made a lot of progress. I mean, just in the last couple of years, we've had over 2 million new people start to carry concealed handguns. It's over 7 million now. You have states like Pennsylvania, which is over 800,000, about 840,000 in Florida have permits.
And ironically, John, ironically, the FBI says crime rates are starting to go down a little bit. Maybe this has a lot to do with it. John Lott, thank you as usual. I'll be back in a moment. Michael Tellinger joins us as we're going to talk about some ancient mysteries on Coast to Coast AM.